This is an 8-iron, and it's a dead shank.
Wow.
Way right.
Oh, takes a hop off the path.
You got to be kidding me.
Very tough pitch shot right here. You got to hit it into the hill. One hop up and bite, and it's in.
Kind of like that.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? This is Jay from Sub70. It is April 15th, and the final round of the RBC Heritage is wrapping up. They teed off early today due to some possible thunderstorms, and Siwoo Kim is currently leading by 2 strokes. Poulter has been there all week. He's fading a little bit today, but still incredibly impressive this season to see him bounce back after, you know, retaining his card basically due to a mathematical screw-up by the tour. He's been playing incredible golf, especially over the last month, and whether you love him or hate him or, you know, are indifferent, it's good to have him and guys like Bryson DeChambeau in contention because they are definitely characters and they definitely are entertaining to watch at the very least. The interview on this episode of the podcast is with Ben Curtis. Ben is the 2003 Open champion. He won that event at Royal St. George's and was only the second golfer ever to win their major championship debut, joining Francis Ouimet. Ben joined the podcast and spoke with Jason. They talked about growing up, playing on AJGA events, going to Kent State and playing college golf there, his time on mini tours, including the Hooters Tour, and then eventually getting to the PGA Tour, winning that Open Championship early in his career, kind of how that set the tone for his career, how that might have changed things and expectations and that sort of thing. But Ben did notch 3 more victories after that Open Championship, taking him to a total of 4 PGA Tour victories. They also did a little bit of a Masters recap. The interview took place right after the event wrapped up, and also spent quite a bit of time talking about Ben's transition from being a PGA Tour player to starting a golf academy and going over into the instruction and coaching sort of mode. Ben's golf academy, you can check him out on Instagram at Ben Curtis Golf Academy, and his website is bencurtisacademy.com. It was a great talk, you know, really very insightful as far as growing up, playing golf, how expectations and things change over time, and how you have to kind of, you know, roll with that and figure out how to succeed the best way you can. So definitely check it out. Thanks to Ben for his time. If you guys have any feedback, you can always hit us up on social media at GolfSub70. Here's the interview.
I would like to welcome to the podcast 4-time PGA Tour winner, Open champion, Ryder Cup member, Ben Curtis. Ben, thanks for taking the time today to be on the podcast. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Jason. It's great to be here, and I look forward to our conversation.
Well, I'm assuming you're still a golf fan on top of being a PGA Tour player. Did you get a chance to watch the Masters, and what was sort of your impressions on what you saw?
Yeah, I didn't get to much see Saturday, but I got to see most of Sunday and a little bit Thursday and Friday. But, I mean, obviously, looking back on it, you know, Patrick Reed played awesome. I mean, he deserved to win it. I know, you know, I've read a couple things where people were rooting for Rory and Spieth and Ricky and all that. But at the end of the day, I mean, you have to give Patrick a lot of credit. I mean, he made all the putts and he composed himself really well. And yeah, he had some ups and downs here on Sunday, just like anybody else. But, you know, it's hard when you have that such a big lead over the rest of the field. I mean, everybody thought it was going to be a 2-man show, but it was a lot of fun to be able to watch. And Augusta is really great with that. I mean, they always, it always seems to, on Sunday, there's always something great that happens in the charge, or, you know, some guys make a lot of birdies and eagles, but they just the way they set it up. And I think the pins and, you know, guys are a lot more familiar with the course, and, you know, and it's just a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah. I mean, you've played in it, and Is there any other golf course that is any better on that back nine excitement of somebody can go two or three over who's in contention and somebody can go five under or six under, and you just, you never know what's going to happen. It just shows how great of a golf course that is for major championship excitement on a Sunday. I can't think of another course that has that sort of swing potential in it of what you're watching.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, you think, you know, most other majors, if you know, those guys have three or four or five shots over the rest of the field, you think, oh, they gotta make doubles and triples or bogeys to fall back into the field. Whereas there, I mean, you, like you said, you have guys making a lot of birdies, and you know everything happens on the back nine, they say. But then too, the opposite happens. You know, you had Rory a few years ago who had what, five or six shot lead, and then he shot what, bogey golf coming in. So it was like, you know, you can have the other way because of the pressure and, you know, how on you have to be. But, yeah, you get through 10, 11, and 12, you know, even par was kind of the thing when we played. It was like, you got through that even par, then you knew you had a chance to make some birdies, because 13, 14, you know, 14 is not easy, but, you know, if you hit the fairway and you hit a decent shot, you have a good look at it. 15, obviously. 16, you just hit a good 6-7 iron or something like that. You use the slope, you can have a great look at it. And then obviously 17, 18 being difficult. But you have there that stretch there where you can make a lot happen. And, you know, they do such a good job. I mean, you play this, it's funny, well, I'll go on a little bit, but you play those practice rounds and you think, oh, it's not too bad. And then Thursday they turn on the air and they just mow the greens a little extra, you know, roll them and stuff like that. Next thing you know, guys are making six and sevens on the first hole, and you're like, what the heck just happened?
Yeah.
They can flip the switch on that course so quickly, especially if the weather cooperates. And but they do a great job of, hey, by Sunday, we want to see guys making birdies and eagles and climbing back into this thing, and not just let's let the leaders fall back to us. No, we want the, you know, the back of the field to jump up to the leaders.
It really is great theater. It truly is. I enjoyed watching it. The other thing I want to congratulate you on is opening the Ben Curtis Golf Academy, kind of where you're, you grew up in Ohio, and how did that come about, and what's going to be the focus on this new venture?
Yeah, so I'll just give you a little background how it happened. I mean, the last several years playing golf, I just wasn't totally happy with it. Obviously, it wasn't playing good. The traveling with, you know, being away from the family and all that with the kids and being in school, and it just took a lot toll on me, and I just didn't really know my schedule. I wasn't fully exempt, and obviously I knew some of the tournaments I would play in, like the Open and Valero, Texas, and some of the opposite fields, but, you know, some of the other ones would be like, you know, Thursday, Friday before, hey, you know, you can play, or you're on the bubble, where are you going to come, and all that. It just wore me out, and so I just did a lot of things, and it took a couple years of that to really figure out, hey, I need to be home focused. And then, so what happened was, what really got it going was, you know, when I played at Kent State, Herb Page, and, you know, what he's done at Kent State, he's been a big, you know, he's a supporter of mine, a big friend, and all that. So he went down, he had quintuplet bypass surgery, and so he missed the first part of the season, and so they asked if I would volunteer and help out, and I did, and I just really enjoyed it, just being around the guys and the team a lot more, even though I saw them quite a bit living in town and practicing out at the facility and stuff. But really got a chance. I got to travel with them in a couple of tournaments and hang out with them, and I just really enjoyed it, just being a mentor and helping them out the best way I could. And so that's how it kind of started. And so I just said, well, I just started doing a little research and thinking about it, and you know, you got all these academies out west and down south, but there's really nothing like that here, where, you know, my age group is 10 to 18 years old, and, you know, kids want to continue in college and that, no problem. But just get them preparing. It's not just on how to hit a shot, how to hit a draw, and what your swing should do and mechanics. It's, you know, obviously we'll do that with the TrackMan and all the technology, but also incorporate, you know, nutrition, course management, tournament preparation, college prep. So to those kids that are looking to play at the next level, helping them through that process and the physical training as well, and all that stuff. So what it takes to basically become a pro and what, you know, the steps that are taken to get to that point. And so with my background and my history, that I felt like, hey, there's a lot that I can provide to these kids, and, you know, and there's something that's not like that here in the area.
Well, yeah, and I mean, you've won a major, you're a multiple-time winner on tour. I mean, I'm sure your advice to those, you know, high-level playing college students, you know, to have the potential like you did, coming from you, it has to mean a lot from them. I mean, or, you know, to them, from you have the experience, you actually, you know what it takes to do it. Are you going to be continue to working with some of the kids from Kent State then, once their coach kind of comes back full-time? Are you still kind of helping that program out then with the academy as well?
Yeah, so like each year they have alumni trip. I go on with them, and this happened about a year and a half, 2 years ago, but with Herb. But yeah, I still go out there regularly. You know, I talk to the guys, and they call and text, say, hey, you know, in this situation, and they got a couple players, seniors now, that are from this area, Northeast Ohio, and they, you know, one of them, he's an all-mate. He just actually, couple weeks ago, qualified for the PGA Tour, Canada Tour. So he went out to California right after one of the events, and he finished fourth in that. So he has a lot of potential. He's he was an All-American last year. So he's got great potential. He, obviously, they all hit it a long ways now compared to back to when I played. But he's got the mentality and the patience for it. So he's just, we've been talking a lot about what's his next step, you know, and it's a key problem. I mean, there's so many things that go on. There's so many guys that never made it that were great golfers. You know, it's just, they maybe didn't prepare the right way, or they just took the wrong avenue when they turned pro. They just didn't get lucky. They played bad at the wrong time. They didn't, you know, there's a lot of things that could go on. And because like I said, there's so many good players that I played with that never made it to the tour. And you're like, they had 10 times more talent than I did. It's just maybe mentally they weren't as strong, or they just didn't play good at the right time. So, yeah, I'm hoping to keep continuing working with some of the guys, Ian Holt and Chase Johnson. They're great kids, and they want to learn and they want to get better. And, you know, they're scared as well. I mean, who wasn't scared? You know, it's like a guy that graduates from college and all of a sudden he's going to go work at, you know, Morgan Stanley. You know, it's a big transition.
It's funny what you're talking about, the college students hitting it that far. You know, our home country club of Kishwaukee Country Club in DeKalb is where one of the home courses, along with Rich Harvest Farms, where, you know, Northern Illinois University plays. And I'm watching some of these college kids, and it is literally 80 yards past me. And I'm a good amateur player, but I'm 45 years old. We were taught, you know, a different way of playing, easy peasy. You know, the club do the work. I'm blown away of how far these kids hit the ball. It's fun to watch. Like, I think these younger players are getting better and better and better as they're coming through the system. They're, you know, every D1 program's got kids who can really play.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Kent State, they're ranked, I mean, they just finished second down at Texas A&M, and they played against the number one team, Oklahoma State. They won, so they beat Kent by like six shots, but they beat LSU, who's ranked in the top 20. Texas A&M is number two. All these great teams, and it's just a lot of fun to watch. And especially being a northern school, you know, you don't really hear about it too often. I know Minnesota won it a few years back, and then, you know, when I was in school, Northwestern was really good because I played all 4 years against Luke Donald. So, you know, because of him, and they had some other good players as well. So it was a lot of fun. And I think it's just unique. You just don't see that every day. You always hear about Oklahoma State, Georgia's, and Florida's, and that, and Texas with golf. But, you know, a lot of people don't realize that there's good schools around here that offer, you know, great chance to play against great tournament and great competition. So, yeah, you're right. They all do bomb it. I mean, everyone on the Kent State team hits it 300 yards plus. Back when I played, if you hit it 300 yards, you were by far one of the top 10%. Now it's, you know, the top 10% is the guys that don't hit it 300 yards. So
yeah, exactly. It's a different ball game. So are you going to have a certain set of principles as a teacher that you think are really important that you're going to kind of mold these students with? Or do you sort of take the approach with, let's see what this student has. We're not going to make drastic changes if they're a pretty good player and mold that into the best that that player kind of has or what their natural innate ability is?
Yeah, I think you don't want to take away, you know, their athletic ability. It's, you know, I kind of look at it as like Dustin Johnson. Is his swing perfect? No. Are you going to change it? No. You know, he hits it good enough. He hits it straight enough. But his, you know, his strength is his power. And obviously his short game has improved a lot over the course of the year. And that's kind of what I'm going to emphasize to him. Is like, listen, I don't care if your swing looks perfect or not. Can you get it to point A to point B at a fairly consistent level? And let's, you know, work on that short game. You know, 150 yards and in is kind of, hey, that's where you need to be. You know, that's where you need to focus in on, because that's never going to change. You know, the game might change in power and length and stuff like that, but 150 yards and in, that's never going to change. That's where you need to make up and be the strongest. If you're, you know, a great putter, let's continue to work on that. If you're not good at wedge game, let's, you know, let's improve that. But I think the focus would be short game. And then the mental side of it, you know, always be positive and think about good things. Don't, you know, kind of like when I grew up, read Harvey Pinnock, you know, talked about, and Bob Rotella, just, hey, think about the future. Don't worry about the past. And, you know, trying to work on their mindset as well. But those would be the two focused areas. I mean, obviously, technique-wise, it, with the film and stuff, it would be very easy to break it down and say, hey, this is what you're doing, and we need to eliminate this. But keep doing this. You're doing a lot of great things. And, you know, especially being so young, it's just like, let's continue. Hit it hard, hit it far, and we'll worry about the technique, you know.
And you talked a little about this earlier, kind of with starting the academy, but are you, as a competitor, are you going to miss playing against the best in the world? And how do you feel about not doing that any longer? And then my second part of that is, what are you not going to miss about playing tournament PGA Tour professional golf?
I mean, will I miss playing against the best players? Of course I will. I mean, you know, being a competitor that I am, and, you know, that's what I thrive for. Even the last few years, even though I didn't like it as much, but once the bell rang on Thursday, I was ready to go and ready to see how I could stack up against the best players in the world. And, you know, that's kind of what motivated me all throughout my career. I was, you know, I grew up on my grandfather built a golf course. So, you know, everything, we didn't have as much money, and I had to scrape and fight for everything I got. And, you know, they kind of bled into how I play golf as a professional as well. So, but will I miss it? I like Candid, my wife, she's like, hey, I actually miss Augusta this week. And she looked at me, and I'm like, well, I don't. I like watching. It's pretty nice. Yeah, it's less stressful and all that. But do I miss playing a little bit? Competition-wise, yes. I mean, just to going out to play and hitting those 8 to 10 footers and practicing on the technique, I don't miss that. But and I don't miss the traveling and the hotels and the airlines and all that. It's just, it's a lot of work. I mean, you're gone 30 weeks out of the year. And most of the times it's 6-7 days at a time. So, or if not 2 weeks or 3 weeks. So it takes a lot out of you, and having a family kind of changed everything for me. And especially when they didn't, when they stopped traveling, that was kind of like, oh man, they used to be out here 20 weeks out of the year. Now they're only out here 3 or 4 weeks. It makes a huge difference. So
would you consider, cause I'm assuming you would be fully exempt. I know the Champions Tour kind of keeps changing how it had Robert Gomez on, and he was talking about how it changes every now and then. But with 4 wins in a major, I'm assuming you'd be exempt when you turn 50. Would you consider that then at that point in time of getting back out there again?
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, right now I say no. I mean, it's easy to sit here and say, there's no way I'm going out. But it's 10 years away. A lot can change. And, you know, hopefully I'll be well in, established with this academy full time, that, you know, hopefully that'll sustain me enough where I don't have to think about playing and enjoy this and be home with family and friends. So it's hard to say, because it's such a long time. 10 years ago, I would never told you that I wouldn't be playing on the PGA Tour. So it's amazing how things change. So,
well, when you started playing golf, who introduced you to the game, and how did you kind of fall in love with it?
Well, my grandfather, this is a unique story. So my grandfather bought a farm and then built his own golf course. It's a little public golf course, about 6,300 yards. He designed it himself back in 1974. I was born in 77. The second nine was developed in 1977. My dad graduated high school, became the superintendent. My mom had five sisters. They all worked in the pro shop and in the kitchen. And that's how I grew up, you know, 50 yards from the 18th green that my dad built. And we all lived right there on the property, basically. And so I had it right there in my backyard. So I kind of, since I was 2-3 years old, just that's all I've really known was golf, golf, golf. And so I was very fortunate in that aspect. But my grandfather and my dad were kind of my two biggest coaches growing up until I got to high school. So they taught me a lot about the game and, you know, basically, you know, it was the old school. Hit it straight, know where it's going, you know, keep the course in front of you, have a great short game. And a lot of that's still true today. I mean, the game has changed, but a lot of that still rings true today. So it's a lot of fun. And, you know, I had older cousins that played college golf as well. One at Georgia Southern, the other at Bowling Green. So even though they're a little bit older, I got to play against them. And so I got to see what, hey, this is, you know, playing against tougher competition. And this is, you know, playing against them was, you know, a great challenge for me. And I looked up to them. So I wanted to beat them. And we played for pizza or like Snickers bar in the golf shop. So, so that's how I got introduced to the game. And then obviously was very lucky to get a scholarship to come play at Kent State. And, you know, Herb Page has been a big influence on me ever since.
How did you know when you were good enough to play D1? And then as a follow-up, while you were at Kent State, at what point did you know you were going to, you know, turn pro?
Well, when I, you know, growing up, you know, I played a lot of junior events around Ohio, and then my parents saw that where I wanted to keep playing and growing, and so we scrapped around and got some money and played a couple AJJ events. I won a couple, you know, 13, 14 division, then I won a couple 15 to 18. And so that allowed a lot of the coaches to see some results. And I was looked at Oklahoma State, obviously Kent State, Minnesota, Ohio State, and even Georgia Tech, you know, all kind of, you know, I was on their radar. And it just came down to, I just knew the guys on the Kent State golf team and, you know, just, you know, love what Herb Page and what he had to offer and the school and all that. So that was there. And then, you know, when I went, I mean, obviously since I was a kid, that's all I dreamed of was playing on the PGA Tour. And then when I finished, I went to the semifinals of the USAM out of Pebble Beach in 1999. And that was kind of the, all right, I can do this. You know, lost to David Gossett in the semi, and he ended up winning the tournament. And that was kind of the, hey, this is something I need to work hard for to try to do. And that was kind of the breaking point.
And then when you did turn pro, did you play the mini tours right away once you turned pro, or did you try to go to Q school immediately, or how did that sort of transpire?
Well, I went to, because I was ranked the number one amateur when I turned pro, I got a couple starts on the PGA Tour, but then in the fall, then I went to Q school, didn't make it through the first year, made the second stage, but just missed out going to the finals. So then I played the Hooters Tour back then in 2001, 2002. And then my third time through Q school, I made all the way through the finals, got my tour card, and that's how I got on the tour. So
what's that grind like on the Hooters Tour? I mean, you got to have some great stories from that. Was McGirt out there at that time? There's got to be some characters. And essentially, that's how you learn how to play, right? Because essentially, if you don't play well, this could be financially a disaster, correct? I mean, it's tough.
Yeah, I mean, you think about it. I mean, just to tee it up in the Hooters event, back then we were paying $1,500, and I think that was like the 10th place finish on the in that event. So if you didn't finish top 10, you didn't even get your money back that you put in to play that week. And that's not including the travel, the hotel, the food, and all that good stuff. We carried our own bags. They had ping carry bags, so we all carried our own bags. And it was a lot of fun. I mean, you got basically 50% off food, and I think you got 10% off drinks, so, you know, alcohol drinks. So we'd all be hanging out at the Hooters every tournament. And we'd drive 20 minutes to go, and then the Waffle House was the other big one. You go in there before the round, and there'd be 50 golfers in there eating Waffle House. So it was a lot of fun. I traveled with Greg Boyette, who went to Akron. So him and I basically traveled together and drove around the country. But it was mostly in the southeast portion of the country. But it was basically the only tour that actually traveled and played different places, and that was 4 days. Some of the tours like Tight Lies and the Golden Bear, you basically just set foot in one spot and, you know, basically rented an apartment, stayed there, and then played tournaments, 2-3 day tournaments around that area. So it was actually the only one that mimicked kind of what the tour and the, you know, the web tour was like. So
did you become a better player from going through that?
I think so. I think, one, the competition was good. I think Zach was out there. Johnson was out there for 2 years, and he won basically everything. But yeah, the competition is just learning how to. That was the first time. Hey, this is all on my own. It's not a team, or you know, not traveling, having the university take care of everything. I mean, you had to book your own flights, or book your rental car, book the hotels, and all that good stuff. So you had to learn how to do it on your own. I think the only difference was you just did it on your own versus, you know, you get on tour, it's kind of, you have a team, right? You have a caddy, you have your agents and all that that kind of help you, you know, make that transition. But to be able to learn how on its own, it was a lot of work, but I learned a lot from it too.
And I was, you know, when I was doing my outline for this, I know you got through all stages of Q school, which is a heck of an accomplishment. It's hard to do. So you didn't spend much time on the web.com tour. So how was that transition basically going from mini tour lifestyle to kaboom? You're on the biggest tour in the world. How was that adjustment?
It wasn't easy. I think, you know, because I finished right in the middle of the pack, the hardest thing I found, it wasn't a booking the flights, getting the hotel room, because I was used to doing that for a couple of years. It was more or less, what weeks am I going to get to play in? So, like Hawaii, you're sitting on the edge of your seat, you know, till the last minute, and then you find out you're like 10 or 12 out, and then some guys withdraw over the weekend. Next thing you know, you're like 4 or 5. So you're kind of looking up flights and hotels. It was just the unknown that was always the hardest for me, even after. You know, when the last few years of my career, that was always the hardest, not knowing. You know, other than that, that was the hardest thing for me. And then obviously the golf courses, you know, they were a lot more challenging. They weren't, you know, you were used to shooting 12, 15, 18, 20 under par on the Hooters events. And all of a sudden, if you just shoot one under even par, you actually play pretty good. So just learning how to play the tougher courses and learning how everything works, you know, with, you know, once you get to the course, how much time you need. You got all the media, fans, autographs, stuff like that that you didn't have to take into account before. So you had to learn how to manage your time, I would say, a little bit better. But the hardest thing was, you know, not knowing when to start. But once the season got going and you move, you know, I made a couple cuts and got to move up and knew that, hey, for the next 3 or 4 months, I can play basically whatever tournaments I want other than the majors and stuff.
Well, yeah, and the other downside is you probably didn't get your drink discount and food discount at Hooters anymore once you're on the PGA Tour, right? I mean, maybe, hopefully they extended it to you for at least one more season.
Well, yeah, and all of a sudden, yeah, you're paying $200-$300 a night for a room versus versus you know, 50 or 80 bucks staying at Motel Sixes and Red Roof and all that good stuff.
So when you get out there, did you feel your game was good enough to compete at the PGA Tour level, or were there things you needed to work at? And then as a follow-up to that, was there ever a surreal moment where you're just on the driving range or practice round or something where you're just like, holy cow, I'm out here playing with X?
Yeah, so like the first tournament I played was Pebble Beach. And so you play, I forget who the other, I played with another rookie. And then you play with two amateurs. So it wasn't, that was okay. It was just, you know, you're out there six and a half hours. That was the hardest thing about that event. Plus it was raining every day. I remember that. My second event was Torrey Pines. So you had two courses. So there's a lot going on there just to learn it, to play, you know, both courses. And then my third was opposite field at Tucson. And then my fourth event was actually Bay Hill. And that was kind of like, oh, this is big time. This is the first event that you're playing against the best players in the world. Phil, Tiger, VJ, Ernie, all them guys. And I made the cut. And I when I came out, I played with Johnny Miller's son, Andy Miller. So we played a lot, and we played together the first 2 days there. And I remember we were talking, we were both making the cut, and we were like, man, this is pretty cool, huh? And then on Sunday, I got to play with VJ. And that was kind of like an eye opener. I'm watching him play, and you know, to me, that at that time, it was like, this course is big time. I mean, the way they set up, the firm fairways are really firm, the greens were always rock hard. And then I'm just watching VJ from 180 yards just taking it right at the hole on every shot. You're like, so that's how they get good. They're not afraid. I was like, oh, I aim 10 feet, 12 yards left or whatever, right? Take the fat part of the green and try to two putt or make a long putt. But, you know, that was kind of the eye opener. It's like, you got to take more dead aim and you got to be a lot more aggressive on the tour than you maybe do when playing amateur or the Hooter stuff.
Well, and that's when, I mean, seeing VJ up close, that's when he was in his absolute prime. I mean, he had to be, I mean,
he was top five in the world. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, even as, I mean, you're obviously talented, you're out there playing, but sometimes, even when you, I imagine when you see something like that, you're like, wow, that's a whole nother level, even where I'm at. Right. But it's got to be motivation that what you have to do to get there to be at the top, I'm assuming. It's also got to be educational at some level to watch a guy at that level play.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I remember we're on 18, he hit it in the left rough, and from 170 or 80 yards, he hits it right at that back right pin over the water, and there's like 10 yards of, you know, you have basically 5 yards between the water and the pin, another few yards behind the pin, and you're like, man, this guy has no fear. And obviously, we were in 35th place, so at that point, he's just trying to see how much money he can make. He didn't care if he shot 80. You know, he's just trying to make a lot of birdies. But also made you understand that when you're back there, you got to take those risks. Now, you're in the lead and stuff like that. You got to be smart, a lot more, you know, a lot smarter than that. But, yeah, it just shows you that, you know, but as I got older and when I was playing my heyday, I would have been doing the same thing he was doing. It just took me a while to understand that that's what it takes to get to that top level and to win tournaments. So
in the summer of 2003, your game starts to really trend the right direction up to the Open Championship. What was working well for you that time? And, you know, for lack of a better word, why were you playing so well leading up to that?
Yeah, so I think, you know, early part in the year, I wasn't used to playing in January, February, March. So that was something to get a little bit used to. Secondly, I started getting a string of tournaments put together where I knew I was going to get to play. So I could play 2 or 3 weeks at a time, take a break, play a few more weeks. And that's what kind of happened. I got in a nice rhythm and a routine like I was used to playing in the summer, but it just happened a little bit before. Yeah, I was driving the ball very straight. I was never a long hitter. I drove it very straight. I knew where the irons were going. And I was putting extremely well. And each week I could see it getting better and better. And at Cog Hill, that's kind of where, you know, that's what got me into the Open Championship. So I finished, I think, 10th or 11th or something like that, because it was similar to what they do now where, you know, if you weren't exempt, they took the next seven guys that weren't exempt into the Open. They took those top seven finishers on, so I was able to move on and play. So, yeah, it was basically putting. I mean, you look at the final 2 days at the Open, it was all putting that made the difference.
And then when you get to Royal St. George's, you see the golf course. Did you see that it fit your eye or your game from the very start? Were you comfortable right away out there?
I was never comfortable, to be honest, because, I flew over a little early with Candace, and she kind of walked around the course with me on Friday and Saturday before the event, because I'd never been on Lynx Golf, and, if you've never been there, it was actually the one that had the most mounds and dunes and stuff that were actually in your view. You know, a lot of the courses over there, the dunes and stuff, are kind of shape the hole, but there, they don't. They're kind of, you kind of hit over them and into the fairway, so it was very hard to see. And plus, you're not used to playing a course where there's no trees and it's just high grass everywhere. And it was hard to see where the lines were off the tee. So it was very intimidating. And I actually was just going over some stats just for the academy. And, I think I only hit 56% of the fairways that week, which was still top 10, but that just shows you how difficult it was to kind of see where you were going. But I was never fully comfortable, but I felt good around the greens. Cause I was always, when I grew up playing and my grandfather would, I'd show up and he would take three or four clubs out of my bag. And I would be like, where's all my stuff? And he'd say, you got to learn how to use all these different clubs, and especially around the green. So I was never afraid to use like a 6-iron or 7-iron or something chipping around the green. And, not like Seve was, but, to a degree where I could, if I needed to use a 7-iron out of the rough into a tight fairway or, tight pin, I could do it. But so I just felt very comfortable with that. And then obviously the weather cooperated. It was somewhat warm, but it wasn't too windy. I think, going over there the first time, like the next time we played at Roy St. George's, that's when Darren Clark won, and it was blowing 50 every day. So it was, it was very adaptable to the conditions where it was.
And then after two rounds of golf, you're right there. What's that pressure like for, playing in your first major and, you're right there potentially for the victory. How do you process that?
It's really, it's hard to explain. You kind of get, when you're playing that good, you kind of get in the zone and you kind of block everything out. Cause I remember, I played decent. Like I struggled a little bit Saturday in the first nine, but I played really well in the back to get myself back into it. And then, that's where the confidence really, because that course, most of the guys played well in the front and then just kind of hung on the back. And that's kind of how it happened on Sunday. I got off to a great lead and then the play was like 5-under through 11. And all of a sudden you're just hanging on for dear life coming in. But that just gave me a lot of confidence. And we were getting ready to go to bed the night before. And Candace looks over and she goes, how do you feel about tomorrow? And are you nervous? I said, well, I'm nervous, but I said, I'm going to win. And she just kind of kissed me on the forehead, rolled over, and said, didn't say anything for the rest until I saw her after the round on Sunday. So she just kind of went mute. But as an athlete and as a player, I just felt really comfortable with what I was doing. And, my main focus the night before was just hit the fairway on number one because it was the toughest driving hole. And I just felt like, and once I did that, a big weight went off my shoulders. I relaxed and on I went. But who knows what I would have done if I missed the fairway. So it's probably not the best psychological thing to be thinking is if I just hit the fairway and won, I'll be fine.
Yeah, and then round four is interesting, right? Like you're on, and speaking of hitting the fairway out the first hole, you're 6-under through 11.
Oh, 6-under.
So obviously is that correct on that nine?
Yeah, it sounds, I thought it was five, but you're probably right. It might have been six. Because I'm trying to think. Yeah, because I bogeyed 14, 15, and 17, and I finished 2-under. So I would have been 5-under.
You're 5-under through 11, so it starts off great. Then you have a couple of bogeys, and then you make one hell of a clutch par putt on 18, and then it's a waiting game, so that must have been an interesting scenario to kind of try to wait out, or are you going to win the Open Championship?
Yeah, I mean, it was weird. So, you know, I finished, and apparently I remember holing out on 18, and, you know, they applause, and you kind of wave and all that, and then right as I – as applause stops, some guy yells out, "You are now in the lead." And that's when Bjorn had that little mishap on 16. So it was, so that was very, so then I got really nervous because at that point I thought I was just going to finish second. I didn't realize that he made that mistake. And so I get in there and they kept replaying it when I'm signing the scorecard. And then when I came out, one of the RNA people said, "We're going to take you to the range." I'm like, okay. So I hadn't even seen Candace yet. So and she was the only one there with me. So they put me in a cart with my caddy and they whisk us around 18 behind the green and over to a little parking lot onto the range. And I'm on this range. It's 80 yards wide or whatever. And there's four camera guys and me and my caddy and an RNA official just standing there. So it was really bizarre. I mean, if I had it over again, I probably would have just waited behind the score because they were on 17 at that point. So it would only been another 15 or 20 minutes knowing if I was going to get in the playoff. And it was 85 degrees, so it wouldn't have been an issue of being warm or not. So they kind of wanted me just to hit balls and all that. So if I had it over again, I probably would have stuck more with her and, you know, just took it in a little bit more. But, you know, I'm not going to change it now. So, you know, it's just, and it's very nerve-wracking. I was probably more nervous in those 20 minutes than I was when I was playing.
Did you have to get yourself ready for a playoff, though, mentally? I mean, did you sort of let it go that the round is over and start preparing for that three-hole aggregate playoff in your mind of thinking, you know, he's probably going to par 18 and, or potentially, you know, tie you on 18 and you're going to have to go back out there?
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, because you couldn't see anything in the grandstand because it was kind of a couple hundred yards away, but you could hear the moan and groan of the crowd. And so him and VJ, so Bjorn and VJ had a chance on 18. And you both needed to make birdie. And Bjorn or VJ hit in the bunker. And my caddy went over to this trailer and he said, "Hey," about 50 yards away or so. And he's like, "VJ's in the bunker. He's hitting the shot now." So you hear it and you hear the crowd and they cheer like it's going to go in, but he left it like a foot short. And then Bjorn was just off the green, maybe 30 feet away in the fringe, and he putted it. And I don't know where he hit it, but he missed it, obviously. And that was kind of the end of it. And it was, but in your mind, you had to be prepared. I was hitting like 50 yard chip shots just to stay loose. And I remember thinking about, all right, what holes are we going to be playing? And I think they said it was like 1, 2, 17, and 18 or something like that. And, so I was just trying to, you know, stay as focused as I can. But obviously, you know, I was thinking about, I can't believe I might win this thing. So to be honest.
Yeah, and then you go through that ceremony and they announce you as the champion golfer of the year. And you're holding I think it's the greatest trophy in golf, just my opinion of, I think it's the greatest championship in golf. What is that feeling like? Is it, how do you even describe that?
It's hard. I think, you know, the emotions that go through you just kind of hit you all at once when when they hand you a trophy like that. And like you say, it's such an iconic piece of trophy. It's, you know, it's not really big and it's, you know, it's got a lot of history in it. You know, right now it was almost 150 years, you know, so you're just holding this, you know, you're thinking, man, Jack Nicklaus, Arnold Palmer, you know, Bobby Jones, all these greats have touched this thing. And, you know, I'm one of them. And it really hits you when you're walking around. So they ask you to talk for a couple minutes. And then they, once that's over, they just kind of parade you around the 18th green. And that was really surreal. You're just like, man, I'm sitting in a bunker, I'm kissing the trophy, I'm waving to the crowd, and it's, all that emotion hits you at once, and it's kind of really cool. I just wish that I, you know, it was great having Candace there, and, you know, we had a special moment, but it would have been nice to have everybody there. So, you know, you kind of think about all these people that have, you know, been there for you throughout the whole, your whole career, and have been big supporters for you, and you just wish that everybody could have been there to enjoy it with you.
Yeah, and sort of a follow-up, you know, what's your best memories of that evening once everything kind of calmed down and it's you and your fiancé and you're there with the claret jug, and then what's the best memories of flying back home and getting off that airplane and seeing all your family and friends and mentors and everybody who kind of, you know, you couldn't have got there without them. What's sort of your best memories of that evening and then coming back home with it?
Well, it was really a strange evening because we were scheduled to drive over by Gatwick Airport for our flight the next morning, but I was with IMG and they had a couple agents there, and they said, well, we have a house, we got a room for you. So we go back there, and there's two agents and me and Candace, and then my two cousins actually came over. One's in, from Chicago, the other's from LA, and they're a little bit older than me, and but they came over, they stayed in London, they came out every couple days to watch, and so we're just the four of us in there afterwards. And my caddy lived in Maidstone, which is about an hour away. So by the time he got home and showered and came back, it was like 10 o'clock. And we're sitting there eating pizza and drinking beer and wine out of the claret jug. And it was kind of weird. There's like six or eight people sitting around. So it wasn't like a big houseful party or anything like that, because everybody else was heading out of town. And then when we got on the plane, the pilot was from Columbus, Ohio. And back then they had a flight from London to Cleveland on Continental, and the pilot was from Columbus, like I said. So we, you know, he invited us up to the front, and we got pictures in the cockpit and all that with the claret jug. And then, and we landed in the Cleveland airport, and I don't know if you've been there, but the whole baggage claim was full of, family, friends, and then just, the media and all that good stuff. And it was, kind of came down the escalator and you kind of realized what a big deal this really was, and how much it meant to a lot of people. And obviously being an unknown at the time was, I think, a big, big factor in that as well.
How often do you look at your claret jug, just kind of take it all in and knowing, like those other great players, you're a part of history forever on that thing. Does it still ever, do you ever look at it and just give it that glance of, holy cow, I'm on that thing forever?
Yeah, I do. I mean, you know, obviously over the years, you know, had it and taken it to events and, you know, speaking stuff or, you know, other charity events. And you kind of look at it, you just see how the people react to it more than anything, more than just me reflecting on it. It's more like you, when you take it to a club or, you know, to a charity event and you see how popular that trophy is, it just shows you how big of a deal it really is. And that's when it really gets you. You're like, yeah, I'm on there. You know, you kind of get a big smile and you kind of, your chest sticks out a little bit more because, you know, obviously you're one of not even 150 guys now, and obviously multiple winners. So you're looking at probably 115 or 20 different names. So it's, and even if that, I mean, it may only be 108 different names, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, you watch those commercials that the RNA did a couple of years ago, the first one with the players just holding it, and then that last one they had from last season where they let the fans be interviewed and say, here it is. And you can just see, like, the raw emotion of even the fans holding that thing. It's just, like I said, I think it's the greatest trophy in sports. It's, and my favorite championship. So it's got to be just, a crazy cool moment. Will you play Carnoustie this year? Will you go over there and play because you're exempt for it?
I didn't play last year either, so I kind of, in April when I played Valero at the last, I was just like, you know, that's it, moving on. And
So how did life change for you after winning and after the hoopla's over? What was the good, and was there a downside of having that? Is there a different pressure of being a major champion all the time? Is the expectations higher? Was there some difficulty with it as well once everything kind of settles in?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, being a rookie, there was a big learning curve just to be able to deal with it all. I mean, obviously, the positives were I didn't have to worry about my career for a few years at least, you know, and I had, you know, obviously could play in any tournament that I wanted and all that good stuff. You know, obviously, the negative was learning how to deal with it all. I remember going to New York right after and just the craziness of that, doing all the interviews and, you know, you're like, hey, this should be fun, but I'm sitting in it doing, you know, 8 hours of interviews a day for 2 or 3 days. And yeah, I got to do some cool stuff, but it, you know, it gets tiring. And then, you know, the next week, you know, had a lot of stuff at home with all that. And then, you know, just learning to deal with all that. But once the dust settled after a few months, yeah, I mean, there were all of a sudden it's like, hey, I got to get back to focusing in on golf and, you know, trying to better my career and stuff. And yeah, it took a few years to kind of get used to the pressure and dealing with it. And, you know, before that, no one knew who I was. And all of a sudden, everywhere you went, everybody knew who you were, especially on the golf course. And, it, you know, people expected you to win or finish second every week or top 10 at least. And, you know, when you don't do that, you're finishing 20th or 30th or 40th. And people are like, what's wrong with you? And you're, you know, I'm trying to still find my way. I was still a rookie and I was still, you know, a young golfer on tour. So it was, you know, just learning how to deal with all that. Yeah, it was very difficult. And that's why I think you look at some of the other guys that have won several times before they won a major and how much different they actually played after. You know what I mean? Like they were used to it a little bit to a sense. You know, they were used to winning the, you know, the Hilton Head tournament or whatever. What that comes with winning a just a regular tour event. So, you know, so there wasn't, I mean, the only negative was, is I remember Candace like, hey, can you go get us some milk? I'm like, yeah, sure. I run out. Then I'd be gone for like 2 hours and I'd come back with no milk. And she'd be like, what happened? I'm like, well, I walked 2 feet into the store and someone recognized me, talked to me and walked, you know, you just, you know, all of a sudden everybody knew who you were, especially being in a small town like Kent, Ohio, where we're from. And I mean, people knew who I was right away. And it was, you know, just dealing with that was, you know, just took some time to get used to.
Yeah, I could imagine. I mean, that's got to be kind of, like I said, imagine that hundredfold of what, like, Tiger had to live like. That's got to be hard.
Right.
You know, it's got, like I say, you just can't go grab milk. You just can't go to a restaurant. And you don't want to be a guy who doesn't take the time to say hello to people and talk to them either.
Right. Right?
I mean, you can't run that way either. But it's, like I said, it had to be a surreal experience, keep using that word, from going from rookie on tour to major champion that quick. And in 2006, you get, you know, really solid year, and you get two victories that year. Was there a lot of pressure to back that major championship up with some other wins on the PGA Tour, and how satisfying was it to get two in a year?
Yeah, I mean, after, you know, 2005, I remember, you know, sitting down and did a couple of interviews and, you know, around here, and people are like, well, what's wrong? Why haven't you won again? And I'm like, well, you don't realize how hard it is to win out here. I mean, it's not like you just because you won a major and your name's Ben Kirk doesn't mean you're just going to show up and win. I mean, you know, Tiger, there's some greats, obviously. And yes, there was some pressure. I was starting to feel it about then. And then, you know, 2006 came around and I started working with Hank Haney and his assistant, Steve Johnson, and kind of got me going back on track and got to hang out with Tiger a little bit and just learning what, you know, the process of what he goes through. And we were just talking about the swing and all that. And yeah, and it helped and, worked extremely hard and yeah, good things started happening. And it started a few weeks prior. It wasn't like all of a sudden, boom, I started playing good. It was like some stuff started happening, even though I shot like 20 over par at Wingfoot and it was extremely difficult, but I could start to see like really good things happening. I was hitting a lot of fairways. I was, you know, hitting some solid iron shots. And the big thing was the putting started to come around, you know, and that's what I found out over time. Like every time I played really good, I look at my putting and, you know, and stats and stuff. And, you know, they're a lot better than what my average was. So it just shows you the difference that just the putting can make in someone's game. And that's the difference on the tour, where there's such a small line between, you know, winning and losing.
Well, let's talk Ryder Cup. You were on a victorious team. How was that experience? And it seemed like Captain Azinger really had a great plan for you guys when you were on the Ryder Cup team. So how was that experience for you?
It was awesome. I mean, I remember after the PGA, he called up and said, hey, this is before he made his choices for his captain picks, and he only had two at the time. And he's like, here's what I'm thinking. Here's what we're going to do. And the thing is, he stuck to it. He says, I'm going to put everybody in group of fours, and you're going to all just hang out. You're going to be a small group, small team. You're going to play all practice rounds together. You're going to sit together at meals. You're going to talk, strategize, and then I'm only going to partner up with one of these three guys that you're with. So it's not like I'm going to have you here and then put you with somebody else from a different pod, that he called them. And so he stuck to it, which was the big thing. I mean, it could have been easily, well, things didn't go well on that first morning or whatever. He could have been, all right, screw this, we're starting over. But no, he stuck with it. And then what he did was, too, is then each assistant was responsible for each pod. So we had, drawing a blank here, who was there? Sorry.
Who was in
but
your
anyway,
pod?
Yeah.
Who was in your pod?
Well, so it was Stuart Sink, Chad Campbell, which was a pick, and Steve Stricker. So he put Stricker and myself together. We did the best ball. And then he had alternate shot with Chad and Stuart Sink. And we just hung out, and we're all, and he put us kind of similar in how our personalities and our golf games were. And so that's where, you know, I knew Steve a little bit. I played with him at a few times, and he was in the final group with me at Booz Allen in 2006. So I really got to know him a little bit more after that. Like, we started talking and played a couple of practice rounds together, and he's a Midwest guy. So, you know, we had a lot in common, and so it was a lot of fun. And then, you know, obviously Stuart and Chad were, you know, kind of mild mannered like we are. And it was perfect. And he put all the wild guys together, like Anthony Kim and Phil and, you know, the guy, Boo Weekly, and who else, he might have had JB Holmes in that group as well. I can't quite remember, because like I said, we didn't hardly, you know, it was like we just stuck to, you know, we played games together, we played practice rounds. So you didn't really get to spend much time with the other guys. So, but it was a lot of fun. And obviously being in the U.S. and the crowd got behind us really well. Now, the only thing I regret, I wish I would have been able to play one in Europe. I think it would have been fun to be on the other side of it, just to see what the atmosphere was like, and, you know, not having everybody for you, you know, kind of thing. So,
well, one of I was actually going to ask you about this. One of your teammates is like an urban legend at this point, or like a ghost, Anthony Kim. Like, how well did you get to know him, and what kind of guy is he, and what kind of teammate was he for, you know, with you on the Ryder Cup?
Well, like I said, I didn't see him much throughout the week, because, you know, we didn't hang out a lot together, other than the three guys that I was with. But yeah, I mean, he was fine. I mean, he was joking around. He was kind of like the young kid. You know, he was partying a little bit in the room, but nothing too serious, you know, nothing serious wrong. It was just, he was young. He was 20, 21, 20, whatever, 23 maybe at the time. And obviously a super talented kid. He was out there. He was having a great time, and he wasn't afraid to show it either. But yeah, I don't know. I've heard he's living in Dallas, and his hair's way down to almost down to his butt. And
yeah, like every now and then on Twitter, you'll see like a random picture of him at like a poker table in Vegas. Or like I said, it's almost like an urban legend anymore, if you can actually, you know, find out what he's doing. He had such talent. It's a shame he got injured and could never fully show it off. He's a hell of a player.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, he had all the shots in the book, and he was fiery. He was good for the game, you know, for that side of it. He could have been one. He had that much shot. I think he could have challenged Tiger, but I think the fame and all that came with it kind of got to him a little bit, the money. And I think he, I don't know if he was sheltered or his parents were too hard on him. It was kind of like, you know, I'm my own man now. I'm going to do what I want. I'm going to party. But, you know, it's a shame that it happened, and he was great for the game, and hopefully he can make a comeback. But I haven't heard as far as what he's doing or what's going on. So
Sunday's Ryder Cup singles matches, what's the pressure like compared to a normal tour event or even a major? And is that the most pressure you've ever felt in your career? Because you're playing for yourself, your teammates, and basically an entire country.
Well, I mean, it would be very similar to how you would feel during the final round of a major. I wouldn't say it's the same. I mean, it's a little bit, I think you're right. It's a little bit different because you're playing for not only for yourself, but the country and your teammates and the captains and all that good stuff. But as far as the type of pressure you felt, it was very similar. And I played against Lee Westwood and remember, but it, you know, you still got to remember, like, it was still like an exhibition to a degree. I mean, we're out there, we're still, even though, you know, I wanted to beat Lee and all that, and we're still out there knowing that, hey, we're putting on a show and it's supposed to be about having a good time and playing good golf. And remember, he had that duel with Boo Weekly, and so we're coming off the fifth green and we're walking back to the tee, and some guy wearing a costume would go walk around going boo, and a ghost costume would say boo right into Lee Westwood's face, and we were just laughing, I mean, our butts off. It just one of those things, like, he's like, only in America or whatever. And we were like, I was like, only in the Ryder Cup that you would see something like this. But that's what it's all about. It's about, you know, putting on a good show and having fun. And, you know, I was very fortunate to be on the winning side of that. But I was very nervous because, you know, Paul, he's like, hey, you're going in the 11th spot. I'm like, my first time around. Can you put Furyk and, you know, Phil and those guys at the back end of it? But he was like, listen, I want the guys that, this is how he looked at it. He says, I want the guys that can withstand the pressure, that don't get, you know, they don't get too high, they don't get too low, the pre-even keel. Those are the guys that I want at the back end that I can feel comfortable with. So that gave you a lot of confidence going into it, knowing that your first time around and, you know, being a rookie on the in the Ryder Cup, that he had that confidence that you could go out there and get him a victory. So. And luckily, it didn't come down to me. I think we were on 15, and I was up one or two at the time. And they said, I was up one, yeah. We walked up on the 15th green, and Lee came over and said, congratulations, you guys just won. So, and then we still had to keep playing. But that was, you know, a big relief coming off because it was starting to get really tight at that point.
And then your last victory in 2012, you kind of had a six-year gap between it and how satisfying is it to get it after that period of time? And then looking back at your career, how satisfied are you with it? It's a pretty damn good run. 4 wins, $14 million in earnings, and you kind of, you know, you're stopping it on your terms when you want to do it. So how would that last win mean to you? And then looking back at your career, how do you sort of sum it up, and how satisfied are you with it?
Yeah, so, you know, looking back, you know, at that point, I was playing off the 126 to 150 category. And I was kind of coming off a year where I didn't play very well. And after having, you know, 2006 through 2010, I played extremely well. It was, you know, I was just trying to like get my form back, and I was playing a little bit in Europe and the momentum was coming. I played it 3 weeks in the Middle East about a month or two prior, and you could start to see the game improving again. But then I had some time. I had like 2 or 3 weeks where I was home and the weather was crappy. I didn't get to play much. And I get there basically not knowing how my game was and just, you know, just caught fire at the right time. And that's what it's about. It's about having confidence. Like I, you know, played really well the first couple of days and got a lot of confidence. And even though I hadn't been playing that much prior, it just, you know, the confidence is what carried me through to the end. And yeah, like you said, I mean, I, you know, growing up where I grew up in a small town, Central Ohio, to be able to say I was going to win 4 tournaments and a major and play in a Ryder Cup and win nearly $14 million in earnings, yeah, I would have took that in a heartbeat. I mean, I would have been satisfied with one victory, let alone 4. So So I've been extremely lucky, and to be able to call it quits on my own terms, it's something great too, to be able to say, hey, I can walk away from this and not have any regrets and move on.
Well, my next questions are just sort of quick, whatever comes to your mind, no right or wrong answers. So
okay.
Best golf shot you ever hit under pressure?
Probably the Valero Texas Open. I don't know if you remember on Sunday, it on 17, it hit in the, it was just really short hole. So I hit like a hybrid or three with a layup and had maybe 80 or 90 yards. Now my ball was just slightly in a, like an older divot, had a little bit of grass, but it was towards the front part of it. And I was worried about chunking it. So I thinned it a little bit and it went over the green. And I was in no man's land. And basically, I couldn't flop it. I basically had to hit it like a British Open style shot. And I hit like an eight, I think it was an eight iron. I hit it, and it just trickled over the green. But the best I could do was keep it to like 30 or 40 feet. And then made the putt. So those sequence of those two shots were probably the best. That obviously, the chip, because there's a lot of things that could have gone wrong. Could have hit it, could have came back to me. With only having a one shot lead as well. And then that coming back to me, or it could have went off to the right and had a, you know, up over a couple of ridges, or I could have chipped it through the green and into the front side bunker. So to be able to keep it on the green, that was, I know it wasn't like hitting it to 40 feet or 30 feet or whatever it was, it doesn't seem like a great shot, but what the pressure was and everything that I was feeling, that it was extremely happy. And it gave me so much confidence just being able to hit it where I did that it kind of freed me up.
Best golf shot you ever saw a playing competitor hit where you were just blown away on how did that guy just pull that shot off, and that's the greatest thing I've ever seen?
Well, I'll go back to VJ when he on 18 at Bay Hill when he was in the bunk or in the left rough and he six it, and I remember the rough being really thick. You hit it and you couldn't even, you basically just hit it 100 yards, and he hit it to like 6 feet on the last and made birdie. And I was like, that's impressive. One, the strength, but just the balls to be able to hit it there and to take it on at that point.
Coolest thing you ever bought for yourself after a victory?
Well, I bought my wife a convertible for our anniversary or for our wedding anniversary, which was like two or three weeks after the British Open in 2003. So right after I won, I bought her a convertible for our wedding gift. That was fun.
Do you carry a handicap at your home club? And if so, what is your current handicap?
I do not carry one, no.
Do they let you play off to, what are you, plus three, four still, if you've had to play in it?
Yeah, now I try to say I'm a minus three or four, but they kind of look at me like really strange. But
well, if they're letting you play as a minus three or four, I imagine you have people lined up 50 deep to be your partner on that one. So most interesting two or three people you've gotten to meet in your life because of the game of golf, not necessarily golfers, but just, I never dreamed I got to meet this person, and golf was sort of the vehicle that I got to meet them.
Oh, wow. I mean, obviously the coolest thing was in June when we played at the Buick Invitational in New York. We went to me and, well, you know, Mark Wilson,
mm-hmm.
Me, Mark Wilson and Candace, we went into the city on Friday night after the Buick. We made the cut, but we went in. We saw Ledbetter live, and then what, a month and a half later, I'm on his show as a guest. So that was really neat. And met Stallone was there that day, so that was pretty cool. I remember watching Rambo and Rocky and all that growing up. That was a big thrill. And we were sitting on a plane next to Jermaine Jackson one time on the way to Europe. So that was pretty cool.
If you could pick three guys from the PGA Tour, they could be Champions Tour players, to go out, play a fun money game, and have dinner and drinks afterwards, which three guys are you grabbing to make your group, and what do you like most about those guys?
John Rollins, and I would pick Carl Peterson and Jason Bone. All three of us, we just like to have a good time. We're out there. The bets are fun. They're not, you know, crazy, nothing crazy, but you know, when you get a few drinks and as the stories come out, and it's quite a bit of a joy. So yeah, I would say those three guys, just from the stories and playing in different, like Carl played in Europe. So he's got a lot of stories from the European tour back in the early 2000s. And then, you know, John Rollins and I, we're like kind of wine buddies. We like to drink wine. So we'll be talking, be the wine geeks. And then Jason, he's an all around funny guy. He just likes to tell stories and make fun of people. And it's a lot of fun.
Is Carl Peterson like really dry sense of humor like Stenson? Is it just quick? That's how I picture him, of just being like really funny, quick, witty comments.
Yeah, and he's got a photographic memory of stories. Like, he doesn't forget anything. Like, he could tell you what happened 10 years ago on August, like, 15th, back in, you know, London, England at the European Open or something, you know. He just has that, and he can tell good stories, too. So I think that's part of it as well.
Well, I got two more here for you. Did you ever get in the famous Tuesday money games with Phil and any of those guys? And if so, is there any great stories on getting schlacked or taking Phil's money or any of those guys who are notoriously in that group?
No, I didn't get in with that. I usually, if I did play the money, it was with Carl and Jason and Jason Bone and then Tom Gillis, and they would have George McNeil, and and it depended on who was there that week, but it would be no bogeys. So if you could go the whole round without making bogeys, everybody would have to fork off. It wasn't $100 or whatever, but because the pins on tour on Tuesday are usually right on the middle of the slope, it would happen. The guys would go the whole day without making a bogey, but if you did, you got to make $300 or $400. So that was basically, I didn't get the famous, those Tuesday rounds with Phil and Duffner and VJ and that. No.
Best three or four golf courses in the world, and what makes them so great architecturally?
I think Riviera, because it doesn't, you know, architecturally, the holes don't look that tough, but they are. And even though they're not overly long, it's a very, you know, it's just such a well-designed. I love Hilton Head. I just think the uniqueness of it. You play 16 holes basically, and, you know, in a bowling alley, and then the last two you're playing, you know, the 17 is a short little par three, but it's tight. But then 18, you got the 150 yard wide fairway, and I think it's such a unique place. And then, you know, I always talk like St. Andrews, if you're just going to play every day, it's such a magical place with just the one and 18 together and 17 and the bridge and the hotel, hitting over the hotel. And then obviously Pebble Beach is just, you know, with the views and the course is a great design as well. So it's just those four are my top four.
Did you ever get a chance to play Pine Valley?
I have not, no.
Yeah, that's the other. I've heard that's, I haven't played it either, but I heard it's just architecturally fantastic. So I didn't know if you played it and where that would kind of be at, you know, on your list. So,
I mean, I definitely would want to play it. It just, I've heard, you know, and I've heard both sides of it too. I've heard good and bad. I've heard some say it's overrated, and I've heard some say it's the best I've ever seen. So,
well, I can't thank you enough for your time today, and I've truly enjoyed the conversation. I appreciate everything. Good luck with the Academy, and I appreciate taking your hour today to talk to us, and I had a great time like spending that hour with you. I really did.
Thanks, Jason. Yeah, it was a lot of fun, and glad to talk about the Academy and looking back on the career. It was a lot of fun. Thank you.